Love Osho Podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho Podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Subhuti. Subhuti is a former UK political reporter who worked in the British Houses of Parliament and later met with Prime Minister Indira Gandhi and USA President Ronald Reagan in the White House. Subhuti, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks a lot. Hello and good morning. Yes, I'm fine, thanks.
Okay, Subhuti, so tell us a bit about yourself and your background before meeting Osho.
Yeah, well, I was an English journalist. I was brought up in a time when England was mostly white and kind of middle class. And I was brought up in the 60s, 50s and 60s. So it was a time of expansion of ideas. And I was lucky in the sense that in terms of my social ambition, I'd always wanted to be a political journalist in Westminster and Downing Street, Whitehall, you know, the center of government. Through luck, I got to do that by the age of 26. So I was the youngest lobby correspondent in the press corps at that time. So I kind of did a fast forward and I kind of got that behind me so I could go on to other things.
And I'm sure it wasn't just luck. And so what brought you to Osho? How you jumped from being a political reporter in England, which was your ambition, to ending up in India?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, isn't it? You know, it's a mystery why for some people they get a good job and that's enough for them. And then some other people like me, they get a good job and within 2 years they're bored. And there's a kind of sneaking suspicion. There must be more to life than walking out of 10 Downing Street and looking important. So I was a weekend hippie back in the late 60s. So I was a straight journalist during the week, and I was a weekend hippie, and I was interested in meditation, in like macrobiotic food, Eastern philosophy, yoga and meditation. And around about 1974, I guess, I decided to give up journalism to do an intense 40-day process in London. And once I'd given up my job, then it was relatively easy to sort of go shopping, so to speak, around the different spiritual practices and paths that were being offered. And there was a big explosion in the early 70s of Eastern mysticism. It became very fashionable in the West. And one of those was these funny people coming back from India in orange clothes and with these wooden beads around their neck with a picture of Osho. And that, in the beginning, I thought that was very uncool. but then, you know, then a girlfriend of mine, a lover of mine, who'd been with me in London, she came back from India with these orange clothes and these wooden beads. And she was glowing with energy. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. And I thought, okay, you know, there's nothing much left here in London. I better go to India and check this guy out. And that was what happened in March 1976. I went to Pune to see Osho.
Well, I've heard this before. I think there is a discourse of Osho when he says, I attract women and then they will bring men to me. Sounds like that's your case.
Yeah, I think that's about it. It's a good way to do it.
Okay, excellent. So you went to India, you fell in love with Osho, but at some point you went back to London. You didn't give up completely your job. I hear that you entered the House of Parliament with your orange cloth and your weird necklace with Osho's picture on your neck.
Yeah, it's true. What happened was I stayed in Pune for 6 months when I first went. And then I got old job. I got a letter offering me my old job back. And somehow I wasn't done with it. So I thought, you know, let's go back and check it out. And of course, then I was faced with the fact that, You know, there was these, I couldn't wear an orange. I should have really, if I'd done the whole thing properly, I would have worn an orange robe in the Houses of Parliament. I don't know how long they would have let me be there. But anyway, so I settled for a rust colored suit, and my Marla was kind of a little bit hidden under my suit. And, but I did make them call me Sabuti, which was kind of fun. And then after a year, I went back, and to tell the truth, I was only going to go back to Pune for 2 weeks for my main holiday. And I arrived back in the ashram in Pune, and people took one look at me and said, "Oh my God, you look terrible. Where have you been?" And so I thought, okay, I just cannot do this anymore. And I just wrote back handing in my resignation, and I stayed then from 1977 all the way through Pune One and then to Oregon and the ranch.
So let's talk about the fact that, if I understand correctly, you have been involved with the press office of Osho, who is arguably, even today, one of the most controversial people in the history of humankind. So living with Osho in his communes was an incredible social experiment where highly educated people with PhD were cleaning toilets and royal people were gardening and turning into bodyguards. Yeah. How you ended up doing the job you were qualified to do?
Well, it was a bit of a no-brainer, really. Oh, by the way, I didn't have a PhD. I had a BA. But my BA was in politics and philosophy, and of course my journalistic experience was in politics. And Osho was very clear about the fact from the very beginning he wanted a press office. And this seemed a little bit, you know, many journalists coming from the West were confused about this and said, why should an Eastern guru have a press office? And then Osho would say, well, look, you know, all these idiots in the West, any political, you know, organization or any prime minister has a press office. They are just talking nonsense. So if a man is talking truth, don't you think he ought to have a press office? So, that was his approach. And I was a good writer. So, you know, it was a bit of a no-brainer that they put me in the press office. And there, you know, we basically had to deal with all of this negative publicity that Osho was consciously generating, you know, the sex guru and, you know, the orgies and the tantra and the Rolls Royces. And it all started. I mean, it kind of exploded not long after I got back there when a German actress ran out of the encounter group and called the German press agencies and complained that she had been slapped or, you know, there'd been a fight or something. And of course, then the whole thing exploded across Europe. So, but yeah, we were kept busy. My job was basically somebody wrote a negative article about Osho, which happened very often. And then I would write an article against them and send it to the newspaper or send a letter to the editor, basically demolishing whatever they said. It was kind of fun. I mean, you know, it was in a way it was great because I was allowed to use my journalistic skills, including my sarcasm and cynicism, in a very creative way, defending Osho against all these idiots. So, so it was great fun. It was like a battle, you know. They attacked him, we attacked them, kind of stuff like that. It was very lively.
I'm sure you were very busy.
Yeah, you bet.
Did Osho direct you in any way on how to handle media and what to write, what to say?
Well, once in a while he would say, you know, write this or write that. But the main thing for me was, of course, that because I had all this negativity, you know, it's a bit like there's a wonderful Hindu myth about Kali, the goddess Kali. The Hindu gods were battling with the Hindu devils and demons, and the battle was going against the Hindu gods. So I think Durga, one of the goddesses, she gave birth out of her head to Kali, who was basically a killing machine, and you know, she sent Kali against the demons and she was slaying them all. But unfortunately, Kali didn't know when to stop, so she would also start killing gods and goddesses as well. And it wasn't until Shiva threw himself under her feet that she finally stopped. So in a way, I was not quite so dramatic, but I was a bit like Kali. And some, my negativity, which I was used creatively against Osho's opponents, I would also occasionally use against him. So his main task was to keep me saying basically, Subhuti, when you feel positive, you write, and when you feel negative about me, don't write.
Yeah. Saying is that you had the liberty of expressing your negative moods against Osho at will.
Well, the thing was, you know, everybody had negativity as part of their nature. And Osho was well aware of that. That's why he created dynamic meditation, you know, which is, you know, has to be the most unique meditation ever. And you have that cathartic stage in which people can express all their negative emotions and scream and shout and everything. So he was well aware that we all carried negativity, and there were correct outlets for that, and not writing nasty things about him and sending them in for him to read, which is what I did.
It's interesting to hear that he was giving freedom than simply saying, you know, just write when you are in a positive mood. So it wasn't like a censorship, so to speak. Even though he was absolutely perfectly aware of the importance of having a press office, didn't know that he wanted consciously a press office since the very early days to handle the controversies.
Not just to handle the controversy, but also to make, he wanted the whole world to know about him. So, I mean, that was part of the deal. He wanted as many people to know about him as possible in his lifetime.
And he used provocations and even the negative media reports, he used them to actually get known.
Oh, yeah, because you see, he let an Indian freelance photographer, very well-known guy, he came to the ashram, and he knew that there were, you know, there were sensational photos to be taken in the groups where everybody was naked and making love and screaming and catharting and doing all kinds of stuff. And he wasn't allowed to get to it. So he wrote to Osho saying, you know, Lakshmi, your secretary, won't allow me to take pictures in the groups. So then Osho said, well, he said, tell the group leaders that if any of them feel comfortable about having an Indian freelance photographer in their groups, they can do so. And then, of course, people like Sumendra and Tirtha, they all said yes. So he got in the groups and he got all of these pictures, which created an enormous sensation both in India and Germany.
That's fascinating, because normally people who are in charge of movements and they are kind of, you know, cult leader, they tend to hide, to avoid all those kind of bad press. Whereas Osho was doing exactly the opposite, which shows that he was 100% confident in what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole deal with the Rolls Royces in Oregon. You know, he ended up with 93 Rolls Royces, and there was only, you know, one possible reason why he had 93 Rolls Royces, because he knew that the whole world would be, you know, shocked and mystified and provoked and irritated by the fact that there was this, and especially Americans, that there was this funny little foreigner in a robe and a funny hat driving around in 93 Rolls Royces in their country.
And it definitely worked very well, because even nowadays people are still talking about the Rolls Royce and the sex guru and the Rolex and all the rest. So looks like Osho was a genius of media and PR.
Yeah.
So Subhuti, what was the most challenging situation you had to handle in the press office?
Oh, my God. I don't know. Me. I think the most challenging situation is me. My own. I mean, it was incredibly intense in the ashram and also in Oregon. You know, we were in a pressure cooker. People think Osho had a very sophisticated approach to the master-disciple relationship. I don't think so. I think his whole thing was get all the disciples in a pressure cooker, close the lid, turn up the flames underneath and say, okay, you're going to pop. Now just be as aware as you can, you know. So, I never felt that when whatever happened was something that we could always deal with. It was more the internal process, which was challenging, not the external job of dealing with the press.
Well, I love this answer, and I didn't expect that. And it shows a lot about you being there for your own personal growth. If you wanted to be a journalist, you would have stayed in the House of Parliament, I guess.
Right, okay. Yes.
So I can't avoid touching upon Wild Wild Country. What I personally see is a very negative approach to Osho. Media today are reinforcing the old prejudices. We hear the same story about the sex guru, the Carl, the Rolls Royce, etc., etc. So looking at the media reaction to Wild Wild Country, from your point of view, do you see any difference from the 80s to today in terms of the perception of Osho?
Okay, so the first thing I want to say is I thought Wild Wild Country was terrific. For the first time, what we had there was a major Netflix mainstream documentary series of 6 parts, which actually tried to tell both sides of the story, and actually gave a lot of camera time to people like Niren, who was Osho's attorney, and Sunshine, who was one of the PR girls on the ranch. And they were allowed to say a lot of interesting stuff. And for me, the two guys who made that series, they knew that in order to sell something to the mainstream, it had to be sensational, and it had to be, you know, had to be a lot of negativity in it, and the crimes, and, you know, the allegations and the deportations and all that. But they managed to get the other side of the story in as well. And they even said in one of their interviews that we would have actually liked to have been on the ranch. The ranch, it looked like a wonderful place. And that did come through, of course, you know, only, I mean, everybody anyway is going to see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear. And, but I thought the Netflix series was fantastic.
Okay, so Osho's name is still very controversial even today after nearly 30 years from his departure. Many people advise me to never use the word Osho if I wanted to have a business and share his meditation to avoid controversy and problems. And clearly I did not listen to that. My website is loveosho.com. What would be your advice to someone who wants to open a meditation center or run a meditation event but is concerned about using the word Osho for fear of bad press and controversies?
Yeah, there's no one answer to that. Everybody, you know, has to make their own assessment. Everybody is free to do what they want. And Osho was very clear about that. Let me just go back to the thing about, publications. I got to tell you this, because at the end of the ranch, you know, when all these allegations were flying around, you know, he was being interviewed by the press every night. And one time it was the turn of the Rajneesh Times, and I was working, which was our local, you know, community newspaper in the Oregon commune. So it was our turn to interview him. So I was sitting in front of him, and I said, because I was kind of irritated, but with him at that time, because to me, he should have got rid of Sheila as the commune leader much earlier. And that would have avoided a lot of the problems that came down on us. So I sat in front of him and basically asked him if we could, if the Rajneesh Times could now that Sheila had gone, were we now free to criticize, the Rajneesh organizations, which of course underneath meant, can I also criticize you? And he, you know, he looked at me like, you know, I don't know, with some compassion perhaps, as I slipped back into my journalistic ways, and said, look, he said, if you want to print the kind of stuff that appears in other newspapers, he said, you just take my name off the newspaper. Because you know, anybody, any newspaper can fill its columns with sensational stuff, and you will definitely sell more copies if you do that. But he said, but then it's not my newspaper. And he said, you have accepted a vision, and it's your creativity to use your newspaper to make that vision understandable to people in various dimensions. And then he looked at me and he said, but if you write something against me in my newspaper, and there was a long pause, and he said, you are not being a gentleman.
So
and I cracked up because I was not expecting to say that. I was expecting to say, then you're not being a good sannyasin or a good disciple, you know. But he said, then you're not being a gentleman. I thought, and that was so far out. I really appreciated that because it was like, you know, that English gentleman stuff. Exactly. You know, he really connected with me then. And I thought, okay, all right.
You found the right key to open your heart.
Yeah. So it was, that was fun. So, yeah, I mean, and there were people who after the ranch, there was, I think there was at least one or two magazines in Europe, which were sannyasin magazines. And they decided to take his name off and write what the fuck they wanted, or what the hell they wanted, excuse my French. And they did. And then Osho said to, you know, the people who wanted to complain to them and go out, and he said, no, no, they've done what I've said they need to do if they want to be negative. And he was totally okay with people doing that. So to answer your question about people who open businesses or open meditation centers, it's really their own judgment if they want to go full public on Osho or, and also, of course, you know, meditation centers, if they want to be affiliated to Pune, then they also have to sit within a certain frame of, what they do and what they don't do. And many decide either to do that or to go their own way. And really, it's up to everybody to make their own choice on that. It yeah. just depends on the circumstances. I'll tell you one thing. I was, just after the, around the millennium, I was going, spending time in the summertime in a hotel, run by a friend of mine in Germany. And, she had a policy of, people should not use their sannyas names and should not say where they had come from, you know, from Pune and Osho and all that. And I was okay with that for a while, but after a while I thought, no, this is not the kind of life I want to lead, you know, hiding my true feelings and hiding my true identity. So then I stopped going there and I started coming here to Osho Risk in Denmark, where everything is out front. You know, this is an Osho center. We do Osho meditations and that feels much more comfortable to me.
Chetan and myself, we feel strongly to be with Osho and we want to be upfront and we feel that Osho is a genius and is the greatest master ever walked on this planet Earth. And we feel we have to put out his name and let people know how he contributed to the development of human consciousness.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're doing and I think it's great.
Okay, so I guess we covered this media part and I'd like to move on and talk about one of your passion, which I understand is Enneagram. I guess not everyone listening to this podcast knows what is Enneagram. So would you like to explain in a few words what it is?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, because it's such a difficult thing to sell because of this word Enneagram, you know. I mean, if people... You know, people want to do workshops about themselves. You know, they can do something. They can do primal, that you know what primal is about. You can do tantra, you know what tantra is about, or, you know, breath work or family constellation. But this word Enneagram is so mysterious. It's so obscure that it's not an easy thing to sell, which is a pity because it's actually, for me, it's one of the most powerful ways of looking at myself that I have ever encountered. And in fact, I discovered the Enneagram. Now, I just should explain. Enneagram is a Greek word. Ennea means nine. It's the Greek word for nine. And gram comes from gramos, which means model. So nine-pointed model is the meaning of Enneagram, and it refers to nine basic personality types. Now, I met this system in New York City in 1974, which was 2 years before I met Osho. And basically, there was a guy there called Oscar Achazo, who was very, very well learned. He'd done a lot of research and knew a lot about various different spiritual traditions. And he jumped on the Enneagram as something, you know, which was about a couple of thousand years old. And he gave it its modern psychological dimension, these nine different personality types. Actually, personality type is not such a good name because, as you know, all our personalities are different, but the correct way of saying it would be that the nine basic strategies that children explore in order to fit into or take care of themselves in the family environment. And the system says there are basically 9 ways that children can manipulate or try to manipulate the parents and their siblings. And that becomes around the age, you know, at least by the age of 10, and some people say much earlier, the child obviously fixes on the strategy that works best for them. And that becomes a habit. And like all habits, like brushing your teeth or driving a car, it eventually becomes unconscious. It becomes automatic. So we are carrying around in us an automatic strategy so that whenever we feel under stress or under pressure or insecure, the tendency is for that automatic habit of behavior, a certain kind of behavior, to come out of the unconscious and influence our behavior in a certain way. So from that perspective, we are in fact robots. We're not free because a choice we made back in childhood is still controlling and limiting our behavior. So the whole point of this Enneagram system developed by Oscar Lichazo is to liberate us from unconscious behavior, to liberate us from our strategy. Of course, we could still use it when it's useful, but at least then it will be a conscious choice and not an automatic reflex.
Okay, well, that's a very exhaustive explanation, and justice to Enneagram. No, it's absolutely fine. So I believe
okay,
you...
Just say one more thing.
Sure.
When I came to Osho, I was sure that I was to get all about the Enneagram, because it was all about, you know, get out of your head, get into your energy, and basically stop thinking. Basically any kind of belief system was discarded. But it served as a map to look at myself, which I could never really put. It was a mirror. Ever since 1974, when they told me that I was a number 7, I have been confronted with that in my behavior. And it's been the most helpful and useful tool, you know, that I've discovered. And it's perfect with Osho, because Osho teaches us consciousness to watch the mind, that we are this flame of consciousness which can watch the mind. And the Enneagram gives us the nature of the mind to watch. So they go together beautifully.
And it's beautiful that you have been interested in Enneagram since 1974. So you have lots of experience. It's a long story with Enneagram.
Oh, yes.
I understand that you also run workshops, and you kind of offer and share your experience and understanding of Enneagram with people, and you help them via this tool that you just presented to us.
Yes, I'm not a full-time group leader, but I love teaching the Enneagram. And so if anybody wants me to run an Enneagram workshop in any city, anywhere in the world, they're free to contact me and talk to me about it.
So where can people find you if they are interested to know more about you, your story, and your workshops with Enneagram?
You know, the best place is Facebook. My Facebook name is Subhuti Anand. That's where usually I do most of my social media connections. But I do have a website. It's called anandsubhuti.com, one word. Anand, A-N-A-N-D, Subhuti, S-U-B-H-U-T-I.
Great. And I'll link the website and the Facebook page of Subhuti in the notes of the show. So everyone, no worries, you'll find the links to Subhuti. And interestingly, you are very active on Facebook, so you're truly more than social media man.
You have to be Twitter and Snapchat to be totally modern.
Yes, I need to catch up myself with Snapchat.
Me too, I don't understand it at all.
I also would like to mention that you are a writer. You are author of 5 books. I'm going to mention the 2 that I personally read, The Pune Diaries and My Dance with a Madman. I read them both and enjoyed them both, but particularly My Dance with a Madman. I am, perhaps you don't know, so I'm going to tell you this little story here. I'm grateful and emotionally attached to the book because I read the book whilst camping in Scotland in freezing conditions. It was late April, and I was convinced it would be like spring, but I underestimated Scotland. I was very ill-equipped, and it was completely frozen, like minus in the night. I've never been so cold in my life. So thanks to your book, because it distracted me, kept me busy, and I read it, really saved my life. Okay, Subhuti, so we are nearly at the end. I will ask you now three final questions. The first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Okay, so I'm a very, I don't sleep very long usually. I usually wake up around 4:30, 5 o'clock. When there are workshops and groups happening here at OSHA Risk in Denmark, I invariably get up around 5:30 and go to the kitchen and start making the breakfast for the group. And that is, I love that early morning time, you know, when I'm the first one up and it's dark and then slowly it gets light and people start, you know, staggering into the dining room, into the kitchen, you know, rubbing their eyes, just having got up. And, you know, I make fresh coffee for everybody before they go into dynamic meditation. And then, you know, making the porridge, making the bread rolls and getting the breakfast out so that when the dynamic is over at 8:30, they can come and have their breakfast. And when there isn't a group, you know, I'm still getting up early and sit quietly and enjoy a nice cup of tea like any English gentleman would.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's answered the second question, because the second one is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Oh, drinking a cup of tea. I have to say that probably it's the evening meeting, the combination of meditation and listening to one of Osho's discourses. And of course, you know, I've been listening to so many discourses over the past 40 years that I know, you know, pretty much all of them by heart. But it's not so much what he says as the space that we all fall into when we sit together in the evening meeting. It's something mysterious. Whether you listen, whether you don't listen, whether you lie down and doze, something happens at that, in that communion. And that has always been my favorite meditation. And the other, I must just want to say one, I do have a very, you know, in terms of a classical meditation, the one that I like best is chakra breathing.
Interesting, because it's not one of the most popular one, but in fact, it's very, very powerful.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I always do it in my groups.
Oh, wow. Cool. So I should come to your group one day.
Yeah, let's do one in Singapore.
Why not? Why not? Okay, so the last question is, you lead the OSHA experiment. What does it mean to you personally to be with OSHA today in 2018?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. Yeah, maybe silence is the answer. Yeah, I really can't. I don't think I have the words to describe that. Whether I'm with him or not with him, I don't know anymore. If we meet, then I guess we meet in silence. In emptiness, in nothingness, in beyond the beyond, you know. And the one thing that I do have to say, though, is the reason why I live here at OSHA Risk, I very much enjoy living and working with other sannyasins. That is a very nourishing experience. And that combined with the evening meeting and an English cup of tea, I think that's probably how I relate to OSHA these days.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. That's the end of the podcast. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. You shared lots of interesting facts and point of views. So I really appreciate that. So thank you, Subhuti.
All right. And it was nice talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit loveosho.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.